Nou is dit tyd vir gesondheidsake. My gas vandag is professor Mark Mendelson. Hy is professor in infeksiesiektes en hy is hoof van die divisie infeksiesiektes en MIV geneeskunde by die Universiteit van Kaapstad en die Grote Skuur Hospitaal. Baie welkom professor Mendelson.
Môre.
Professor Mendelson gaan die gesprek in Engels voer. Nou, ek kry heelwat navraag van luisteraars of mense wat vra, hoekom gesels ek met Engelse spesialiste as daar net so goeie Afrikaans sprekende spesialiste is? Maar met al die disinformasie en die pseudowetenskap wat die ronde doen met COVID, is dit vir my baie belangrik om by die feite te hou en om met mense te gesels wat regstreeks betrokke is by COVID. En ek probeer ook om die spesialiste met wie ek te gesels af te wissel. Mense wil hê ek moet met Tros Becker en Dr. Edeling en aptekers en ander mense gesels wat ander menings het. Ek probeer werklik waar by die wetenskaplike feite hou. Dus die gesprek is verder in Engels en dit is omdat ek die beste inligting moontlik vir die luisteraars wil oordra. Professor Mendelson, that was just my short intro, but I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate. So, I want to ask you, is COVID really more serious than flu? Since this was the argument of some people, and can we look at the average annual flu deaths versus the COVID deaths?
Well, again, good morning, Huemora, Marie, and to all your listeners, and many apologies that I can't conduct this interview in Afrikaans. So the answer is no. COVID-19 and caused by the coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, and influenza are not the same thing. And just to be so that everybody's on the same page, when we're talking about influenza here or flu, as it's commonly called, we're talking about infections with the influenza virus. Flu is a term that's often used for the common cold, but only a very small number of cases of the common cold are actually caused by the influenza virus. There are many viruses out there that can do it. But basically, coming back to your question. So, I mean, if you take the global situation with influenza, influenza will account for somewhere between 300,000 and 650,000 deaths a year globally. Now, COVID so far in the last 18 months, as you know, is we're now around 4.4 million deaths, which, of course, is a gross underestimate because the deaths that these 4.4 million deaths are those in people who have had confirmed COVID tested positive, and we know that not only in South Africa but in many countries the rate of testing is low, and therefore we're missing a lot of deaths. In South Africa, if you look at the number of deaths from influenza per year, we usually see anywhere between 6 and 12,000 deaths a year from influenza, and from COVID at present, the confirmed deaths from COVID are about 79,000, but that is an underestimate, as I said, because that's only reporting those that have a positive test. But the actual, if you look at the excess deaths and work it out properly, it's around 220 plus thousand people have died of COVID-19. And there are a lot of other issues, not just mortality, that are different between influenza and COVID. The contagious period, for example, of COVID is longer, and you are infectious before symptoms come for longer than influenza. COVID, the SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus, spreads more easily than influenza, especially this current Delta variant. There are more super spreading events. The severity of disease with COVID is greater in general than in influenza. And there's also the issue of probably an estimate of 10% of people who've had COVID will go on to get what's called long COVID, which is suffering from symptoms and issues around COVID for more than 28 days. And then the complications, again, are different in influenza. The main complication is a bacterial superinfection. We see that very rarely with COVID, but we see many thromboembolic, thrombosis, clots events in COVID patients. We see long COVID, as I said, and in kids there's also this problem, which is we term multisystem inflammatory syndrome, which is an illness that kids get. So all in all, no, I'm afraid influenza and COVID are not the same. Different virus, different death rates, far more deaths, far more severity with at the moment than our normal seasonal influenza.
But then a lot of listeners ask me, then what has happened to our ordinary winter influenza? Do people still suffer from this, or that all the precautionary measures that we take actually inhibit the spread of the ordinary winter influenza?
Yeah. So if you look at the influenza epidemic in South Africa each season, what normally happens is it starts in the Western Cape because of our climatic factors. And it generally starts anywhere between April and June and lasts for a number of weeks. In 2020, so last year, just before we went into the level 5 lockdown for COVID, we started to see cases. The epidemic looks as if it was starting in the Western Cape. We went into lockdown and put in public health interventions, and there were no more cases. And so influenza does seem to be controlled with the public health interventions that we put in, and obviously the reduction in mixing. And also influenza mixes an awful lot in schools and school kids, and therefore the lockdowns and the school closures also reduced the amount of influenza being transmitted. And obviously to start a seasonal epidemic, to get enough people, to start an epidemic, you need enough people being infected to sort of generate that epidemic and what we call the R number.
And then when we look at the MRC's report of excess deaths, do you really think, or is it correct to say that the bigger proportion of those deaths are related to unreported COVID cases? But what about other diseases like heart conditions, diabetes, hypertension, and such that weren't treated as well as it should have been during the lockdown periods?
Sure. So, I mean, when you have not just a lockdown, but I mean, the last 18 months has shown an enormous burden on our health system, and it's well documented that there is collateral damage from within a pandemic, and that's usually that damage is done in terms of other diseases. And we know TB notification rates and diagnostic rates are down, HIV, a lot of other diseases, as you mentioned. But if you look at the data from the South African Medical Research Council and the UCT Actuarial Division, which is where the data is looked at and modelled, what you see is a very, very striking correlation between the proportion of people in the country or in any province being testing positive against the time of the confirmed deaths. Excess deaths from COVID. The excess deaths we see in South Africa. So there's a clear correlation in time. And then when you model these numbers, what we think is that probably between 85 and 95% of the excess deaths are the natural excess deaths are due to COVID-19. And probably somewhere between 5 and 15% are likely due to collateral causes, as you've suggested, other diseases and that are overwhelming the state. But if you key those numbers in, what you're looking at is somewhere around 220,000 deaths from COVID in South Africa since the beginning of the epidemic here.
Professor, that's quite a lot of deaths. But if one sort of, in retrospect, when we look at all the lockdowns and all the precautionary measures that was taken to lower the death rate, hospitalizations and everything, and if you look at retirement villages where people are still in lockdown, do you think these lockdown measures were sort of the right thing to do? And wasn't it sort of not too overbearing? Was it not an overreaction? Or do you think it was correct to do everything as it was done?
Well, I think firstly we learn, you know, on a daily basis about this this disease, infection disease, and our response to it. And I think, you know, in extraordinary times, some mistakes will be made. Saying that, however, you've also got to ask the question of, at each point in time, what the lockdown, so-called, or let's say the public health measures that we're putting in place, are aiming to achieve. So the real aim of the lockdown in March of 2020, when we went into level five, was around the opportunity for the hospitals and the health service to prepare for what was coming. Now, you know also that there is a very intimate link, unfortunately, between alcohol consumption and trauma in South Africa, and, you know, I'm talking about physical trauma, car accidents, etc., violence, and that imposes a very heavy burden on hospitals. So, you know, stopping alcohol sales and the and curfews are not only to reduce, potentially to reduce COVID transmission, but also to reduce trauma-related issues. Because in the beginning, and actually throughout the pandemic, the first thing you need to do is to protect your health service, because if you don't protect your health service, it collapses. Then anybody who becomes sick, or many people who become sick, will not have access to healthcare. So that first lockdown was about trying to give us time. Some hospitals did better than others. Some provinces did better than others. But you know, that was the idea. Then in subsequent lockdowns, the idea has been more to try and radically alter transmission patterns by reducing super spreading events, by, you know, reducing mass gatherings, and also obviously the key features of social distancing, masking, reducing your presence in indoor unventilated areas, etc. It's all about trying to reduce transmission and trying to reduce, therefore, mortality and morbidity and the strain on the health service. So while I don't think everything was done perfectly, and I don't think one can imagine that that would happen generally in a pandemic, and unfortunately the reality is that our pre-pandemic preparedness was not, globally, South Africa included, it was not up to scratch. I fear that we've learnt a lot, but we still aren't particularly well prepared for future pandemics. But in a sense, you know, most of what was required in a lockdown had a reason and logic behind it. There is, of course, also the added, balancing of an economy and people's livelihoods, which is incredibly difficult. And so, again, this isn't a simple thing where there's a right or a wrong. You can make an argument both ways.
Yeah, this is a difficult one, and there are strong feelings about on both sides of the spectrum. But then let's look at the current situation. In the ICU wards at Groteske Hospital, do you mainly see vaccinated patients or unvaccinated patients?
No, so again, I think we need to be clear about when we're talking about intensive care units, what we mean. So as your listeners know, there are, when you're admitted to hospital, you can be admitted to a hospital ward. You may then, if you're even more sick and with very severe disease, you may be admitted to a high care unit. And then if you require a mechanical ventilation, i.e. such intervention that you need your breathing being helped by a machine with a tube inserted into your airways, that's intensive care unit. So very few people proportionally will get onto an intensive care unit. So, you know, we may have 46 or so, around 40 to 50, 40 to 60 beds for an intensive care unit, you know, in a 900-plus bedded hospital. So, you know, just to put things into proportion. But the most severe disease, you know, will go to the ICU and in our hospital also to our high care units where we provide, you know, the penultimate high level of care and oxygen support. Overwhelmingly, in our high care units and our ICUs, we are seeing unvaccinated people. Now, some of those people are unvaccinated because they haven't been eligible for a vaccine as yet. We have very young people, unfortunately, in our high care wards and our ICUs, including, you know, our 20s upwards. There are some people there who have, you know, made a decision not to vaccinate for whatever reason. We do see people who have been vaccinated who do get very severe disease, but it's extremely rare at present. And, you know, that is what you would expect because the vaccines protect predominantly against severe disease, being admitted to hospital and dying. And so they're doing their job. But, you know, it is predominantly an unvaccinated population that we're seeing in our high care and ICUs.
Professor, a lot of people argue against vaccination. And one of the arguments is that although you get vaccinated, you can still carry the virus, you can still transmit it, and you can still get ill. What do you say to those people?
Well, firstly, you know, again, I think everybody in the world would like a vaccine to do everything that you could possibly wish it to do, which would be including stopping transmission of the virus completely. What the vaccine is really there to do is to save your life and to reduce the severity of COVID-19. Now, that doesn't only mean saving your life, but there are people who are being admitted to hospital with COVID-19 who are going to thankfully and happily go home, who are going to have a very long road ahead of them and are likely, you know, a large percentage of those people are likely to have long-term problems, including, you know, long-term problems with lungs, heart, kidneys, diabetes, etc. There's also, as I said, the issue of long COVID. So, you know, the main importance of having the vaccine is to prevent severe disease. Now, the vaccine does reduce transmission. It doesn't reduce transmission 100%, and yes, you can get COVID, but the people that are vaccinated who get COVID are much, much more likely to have either asymptomatic or mild disease than people who are unvaccinated. So, you know, I think we have to be very clear about what we want this vaccine to do. And really, what we want this vaccine to do is to save your lives. And if you, you know, could see what we see, if you could experience what we experience on a daily basis of people dying at the numbers that they're dying and the morbidity, the illness and sickness that we are seeing, you know, I think you'd have a different idea. And, you know, ENCA were allowed into our hospital. They showed pictures of the wards. They showed pictures of the high care unit and the ICU. But it was very sanitized. You know, you don't show the reality of it because, you know, that's our job. That we're here for that. But what we're saying to you is, you know, this is exceptional. Usually we wouldn't want you to know what happens in hospital because it's distressing. And although we are trying, you know, and our health service in South Africa, and certainly my colleagues and everybody at Huddeskier are giving, you know, the most incredible level of clinical service, which you would you would suspect should be the case, and you would hope. But we are seeing people who are severely ill and dying, and we know that this can be largely prevented through a vaccine, and that's why we are so keen that people go and get vaccinated.
Some of the people argue that although the content of vaccines are published and known, that there are quite a lot of unknown metals and other chemicals in the vaccine. How do one respond to that? Because there are groups that actually show that they've found different molecules or chemicals in the vaccine that's not supposed to be there, that might cause, in future, might cause death or infertility and other horrible things in future.
Look, I'm really sorry, but I'm not a conspiracy theorist, and I have not seen one piece of evidence where that is the case. So, you know, because somebody produces evidence doesn't mean that it's good evidence, okay? That's unfortunately, you know, behind the issue of ivermectin and all these other things where, you know, rubbish in, rubbish out. I'm sorry, I don't accept that. The contents of the vaccines are known. Over 4.9 billion doses of vaccines for COVID have been delivered. There are, as yet, no long-term effects that we know of the vaccine. These vaccines, although these are new vaccines, they have been worked on for the last 10 years or so. They've been worked on in cases of Ebola and Zika virus and other things. You know, what is said about these vaccines by conspiracy theorists and using myths and misinformation, unfortunately, is extremely damaging and very, very unfortunate. But I'm afraid I don't agree with your assessment of what people say. And you've got to, at the end, look at the hard evidence, and the hard evidence is not there.
Yeah, I'm just sort of stating some of the counter arguments.
Sure.
Of people trying to convince others not to vaccinate, or because there's quite a lot of people that's against vaccination. A surprising percentage of people advocating against the vaccines, and it's just difficult to ignore their statements, and one has to either prove them wrong, or how should one approach that?
Well, you've got to look at their evidence, and their evidence is extremely poor. The evidence actually isn't there. I have not seen evidence as yet that there are any harmful chemicals or, you know, new pieces of whatever you're talking about in the vaccine that is going to cause harm and long-term effects. You know, that is not the case. What I can tell you is that, you know, people are dying, okay? You know, people are dying of a preventable disease. They're dying in large numbers. They're dying when they shouldn't be dying. These are 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds. They're not 90-year-olds. This is you, your friends, your loved ones. This is serious, Mari. Yeah? This is not time for conspiracy theories and what ifs. This is time for action to prevent and protect yourself. And so, you know, you are dealing with an incredibly traumatized and very, very tired, overworked health workforce that are, you know, losing sympathy at a very, very high rate of knots for the anti-vaccination movement. You come, though, people who don't want the vaccine, come and sit on my ward. Yeah, and then we'll see whether you want a vaccine or not.
Professor, if you have one serious take-home message for the listeners, what would that be?
If you're not vaccinated, go get a vaccine as soon as you possibly can into your arm, because that is what is going to protect you. Be very, very careful who you listen to. Be very careful.
Thank you so much.
Try and make informed judgments, not judgments that come from Google.
Okay, so forget about Dr. Google and listen to Professor Mark Mendelsohn. Hy is die hoof van infeksiesiektes en van die divisie van infeksiesiektes en HIV-geneeskunde by die Universiteit van Kaapstad en die Grote Skuur Hospitaal. Baie dankie, Professor Mendelsohn.
Baie dankie en tot ziens.
Baie dankie. Skakel gerus volgende week weer in.